Welcome to this week's edition of Far West Texas. Readings from the Big Bend Sentinel, the Monahans News, and the Fort Stockton Pioneer, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Kay reading the Big Bend Sentinel for Thursday, October 14th, 2021. Brewster Sheriff Deputy suspended without pay after arrest for solicitation of prostitution, by Abby Perot, ABBIE at BigBendSentinel.com. Brewster County. A deputy sheriff in Brewster County has been arrested for soliciting prostitution last week. Deputy Philip Workman, a school resource officer at Alpine Elementary School, has been put on administrative suspension without pay by the sheriff's office, pending the results of the ongoing investigation. Workman was arrested on Thursday, October 7th, for solicitation of prostitution after the Texas Department of Public Safety and the Pecos Police carried out a sting at a Best Western hotel in the city of Pecos in Reeves County. The Department of Public Safety was the lead on the sting, according to Pecos Police Chief Lisa Tarango. A spokesperson for DPS declined to comment on how Workman came to be the target of a sting operation and who Workman had allegedly solicited, citing the ongoing investigation. Brewster County Sheriff Ronnie Dodson said that the sting and subsequent allegation of soliciting prostitution did not involve minors. The Brewster County Sheriff's Office announced Workman's arrest and suspension on Facebook Monday afternoon. The department wrote, "We anticipate the investigation being concluded fairly quickly once facts of the arrest are gathered." Since the arrest, Workman has bonded out of jail. DPS declined to respond on whether an arraignment date had been set. In Texas, the charge of solicitation of prostitution is now classified as a state jail felony instead of a Class A misdemeanor. That's due to new legislation passed this year by Texas lawmakers, which went into effect on September 1st. First-time offenders can now face a maximum sentence of 2 years instead of one. Texas is the only state in the country to classify that charge as a felony instead of a misdemeanor. Texas legislators this year took that action with the goal of cracking down on the demand side of prostitution and human trafficking in Texas. Sheriff Dodson said Workman has been an officer with the Brewster County Sheriff's Department for over a year. Prior to joining the sheriff's office, Workman studied criminal justice at Sol Ross State University, according to his LinkedIn account. In their statement on social media this week, the Brewster County Sheriff's Office wrote, "There will be a final disposition once the investigation and proper procedures have concluded." David Beebe steps down as Presidio County Justice of the Peace and Marfa Municipal Judge, by Sam Karras. Sam at BigBendSentinel.com. Marfa. Presidio County Justice of the Peace and Marfa Municipal Judge David Beebe announced Tuesday night that he will be stepping down from both his public positions. "My resignation is tendered so as to remain in compliance with extrajudicial activities I plan to pursue," he wrote to constituents in a press release. Beebe's position with the county will end at midnight on December 6th, and his term as municipal judge ended with the fiscal year on September 30th. At Tuesday night's Marfa City Council meeting, an agenda item proposed appointing Mayor Manny Baeza municipal judge ex officio until the council could appoint a new judge. City Attorney Teresa Todd suggested tabling the motion until the next meeting so other short-term solutions could be investigated. City Council will reconvene on Thursday, October 28th. Beebe has served as municipal judge for just over 3 years, a position that became more hands-on with the reinstatement of the Marshall Police Department in 2017. When the previous municipal judge stepped down, the council tapped Beebe to oversee the court. "It's gotten very busy over there," he said of the position. "My wife was tired of me getting out of bed at 3 a.m. When Beebe steps down from his position as Justice of the Peace in December, he will have served over 7 years, just shy of 2 full terms. As a public servant, Beebe has been active on his personal blog and social media, keeping the public informed of city and county business. He hopes his replacements in both positions will act with empathy and do their homework. "I spent most of my first year in office just reading statutes and trying to get familiar with the law," he said. "It's easier now with Google, but you still have to do the reading. I try to be as fair as possible, and that takes a lot of work," he said. "I've learned a lot about people and a lot about myself. It's made me a better person." Early Voting Starts Monday by Abby Perot, ABBIE at BigBendSentinel.com. Marfa. A special election will take place Tuesday, November 2nd, 2021, with early voting opening this coming Monday, October 18th. On the ballot are 2 initiatives that will pave the way for legalized horse betting in Presidio County if passed by voters. The first initiative will ask voters to legalize parimutuel wagering on simulcast races in Presidio County, and the second will ask to legalize parimutuel wagering on horse races in Presidio County. Several amendments to the Texas Constitution are also on the ballot this election season. The 8 amendments will consider a wide variety of topics, like allowing charitable raffles at rodeos or authorizing counties to finance development of transportation or infrastructure in unproductive, underdeveloped, or blighted areas. Another initiative would prohibit the state or its political subdivisions from limiting or preventing religious services arising after COVID-19 restrictions were debated for religious gatherings like church services. Another COVID-inspired proposition will ask Texans to decide if residents of certain facilities should have an established right to designate an essential caregiver for in-person visitation. Other propositions would carve out various tax exemptions for spouses of disabled individuals and for spouses of armed service members who were killed in the line of duty. The full list of propositions is available at www.co.presidio.tx.us under the Elections Information tab. Applications for ballots by mail should be mailed to Florcita Subia at P.O. Box 789, Marfa, Texas 79843, but must be received by Subia no later than the close of business on October 22nd, 2021. Early voting will continue on all weekdays through October 29th from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. North County voters can cast their ballots at the Marfa Visitor Center /USO building at 302 South Highland Avenue in Marfa, while South County voters can go to the Presidio County Annex building at 300 O'Reilly Street in Presidio to make their vote count. On November 2nd, Voters have between 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. to get their ballots in at either polling place. Facing civil suit, D.A. Ori White denies allegations that he wrongly fired assistant. By Abby Perot, ABBIE at BigBenSentinel.com. 83rd District. In late August, former First Assistant District Attorney Jerry Phillips filed a civil lawsuit against District Attorney Ori White in his personal and professional capacity and against Presidio, Brewster, Jeff Davis, and Pecos counties, claiming he was wrongly terminated from the DA's office after attempting to report what he believed was improper and possibly illegal conduct within the office. In newly filed court documents, White has given his first defense against the claims by Phillips, and three of the counties have made motions to move the suit out of a Travis County court and into courts within their own counties. In the suit, Phillips makes sweeping allegations that he was terminated by White after whistleblowing, pointing to four incidents that had occurred or were occurring that he suspected were illegal and that he'd raised concerns over, and a fifth incident that he believes was used as an excuse to fire him. In the first claim in the suit, Phillips alleges Brewster County Attorney Steve Houston pressured the newly sworn-in D.A. White to take back a pending felony criminal case against Houston's grandson after the previous D.A., Sandy Wilson, had turned it over to the Texas Attorney General's office for prosecution. Wilson believed she had a conflict of interest and was unable to fairly prosecute the grandson, Michael Houston, so she relinquished the case to the AG. In the suit, Phillips alleged that White and Houston wanted the case back in local jurisdiction to get a more lenient plea deal. In an email dated to February 2021 that is included as an exhibit, Phillips warned White that taking the case back would, quote, look like you are repaying political support, end quote, from Houston. Despite Phillips' warnings, White entered a motion to take back the grandson's criminal case for a second-degree felony aggravated assault with a deadly weapon from the AG's office. The AG's office told White they had, quote, already put too much work into Michael Houston's case to back out now, and that she would oppose his motion, end quote. White withdrew the motion one day before the hearing, ending the saga. Phillips alleged that Houston had called White prior to White's decision to ask for the case back. The plaintiff said he told White he believed Houston may have violated the penal code through attempting to improperly influence White. Houston, who is not a defendant in the case, was out of office this week and unavailable to provide comment for this story. The first assistant DA documented everything he remembered from the event and sent it to a friend. Quote, I was very uncomfortable because I was put in a position that if I did not take some kind of action, I would become complicit in wrongdoing, end quote, Phillips swore in an affidavit submitted in the lawsuit. Plaintiff Phillips' second allegation is that a civil asset forfeiture, where law enforcement can take property related to a crime, was mishandled. Presidio County Attorney Rod Ponton and D.A. Wilson both filed motions to seize the same $81,000 that law enforcement had taken when arresting a driver who failed to stop at a border checkpoint in November. Phillips alleged Ponton was wrong to file and that, quote, only the felony prosecutor of the criminal matter had this authority, end quote. After White took office and took over Wilson's filings, Phillips claimed the new DA told Ponton he would seize the money and then share it between his office Ponton's office and the Presidio Police. On the day of the hearing for White and Ponton's motion to take the cash, Phillips hastily logged onto Zoom for the proceedings when he found out that no one from the DA's office would be attending. In a strange twist of events, the proceeding over the civil asset forfeiture was memorialized in the now famous Lawyer Cat incident, where Ponton arrived on screen with a cat-faced digital filter and struggled to remove it. Ultimately, the court consolidated Ponton and White's motions and gave the money over to White, who shared it between his office, the Presidio Police, and Ponton's office. Phillips called it cronyism. In response to the claim of cronyism in the suit, Ponton told the Big Bend Sentinel, the state can be represented by the district or county attorney, and that he had filed for the money because at the time, Wilson hadn't yet. A 30-day window was closing and all $81,000 would go back to the man who'd been arrested with it unless someone filed a motion to seize it. Though Ponton is not a defendant in the suit, he weighed in on the case. Quote, all these childish and wild allegations of cronyism and stuff like that is BS, end quote, Ponton said. Quote, there is not anything like that going on in Ori's office, end quote. The third allegation of wrongdoing in the office was Phillips' claim that another DA's office employee, Leticia Carrillo, had been forced to resign, which he believed was on the basis of gender and age discrimination, and was done without clear explanation to Phillips. The fourth and final allegation made by Phillips was that county attorneys within the 83rd District were, quote, habitually contacting unrepresented defendants who had been arrested for misdemeanors, and that contact was prior to the defendant's first court appearances, end quote. Before admonishments, county attorneys would offer plea deals to the defendants. When Phillips brought it to White's attention, the DA said that it was legal. Quote, I had been a professional prosecutor in several other counties and offices and contacting unrepresented defendants prior to court was absolutely forbidden because it was an ethical violation and probably against the law, end quote. Phillips swore in the affidavit. Quote, it's proper, it's approved, it's a normal routine practice to plea bargain minor cases, end quote, Ponton said this week, agreeing with White. Quote, for him to somehow say that if I or any other county attorney dismisses a case, that somehow constitutes the felony of official oppression, they're smoking something too strong to come up with that theory, end quote. Phillips planned to contact the Texas Rangers to investigate the fourth allegation. He wrote a memorialization of everything that had happened for his personal file, but accidentally sent it to Judge Roy Ferguson in May 2021, who forwarded it to White. White told Phillips via email not to pursue an investigation with the Rangers. Phillips believes his firing was because he reported his belief of wrongdoing in these four incidents to D.A. White. In his timeline of events, Phillips explained another incident, which he believed became the pretext for his firing, occurring after he raised issue with the first three allegations and right before the fourth allegation came to pass. In the course of his work, Phillips came across a case that he believed was not properly indicted by the grand jury because they had marked the case as declined, but then also signed an indictment for it. While details of the specific case are not provided in the lawsuit, Phillips filed to dismiss the case. The court, under Judge Ferguson, asked whether Phillips had contacted the case's complaining witness and then ordered him to do so. Phillips believed it was beyond the judge's statutory authority to ask him to do that, and he decided he would not comply with the order. Though Phillips drafted a letter for White to sign and send to the AG asking for an opinion on the matter, White declined to send it. Phillips decided he would allow the judge to charge him for contempt of court, which would move the case under a different judge so he could argue it there. When White called to ask if Phillips had instructed the office's victims coordinator not to send the letter that Judge Ferguson had ordered him to send, he said yes. White terminated Phillips on May 28th. Neither friendship nor political alliance should ever be the basis for a prosecutorial decision, Phillips said in a written statement to the press. It is absolutely wrong to fire an employee who objects to problematic official conduct and or states an intent to expose such problematic official conduct. Our work is supposed to be for the people, never for the personal gain of others, Phillips wrote in his statement. This lawsuit speaks for itself. The only thing necessary for evil to triumph is for good men to do nothing. I am a good man, and I refuse to stand by and do nothing, the plaintiff said. To date, no criminal charges have been filed relating to the allegations of improper or illegal conduct made in the civil suit. In this case, Phillips' attorney Jody Cole does not have to prove that any illegal actions were taken, only that it appeared illegal and that there was enough activity to prove a good faith concern that there were activities that White should have been investigating and potentially prosecuting. Phillips' attorney must then make the argument that Phillips' termination was because he blew the whistle on these actions. Phillips claimed he was fired for whistleblowing and for refusing to commit illegal acts, adding that the firing breached his employment contract and that the DA had intentionally inflicted emotional distress on Phillips. This week, White struck back at the allegations in the suit. Quote, "It's a piece of litigation which I regard as false, so we're just going to fight it," end quote, the DA told the Big Bend Sentinel. Asked why he believed Phillips had filed the suit, White said, quote, "He's not a happy person," end quote, and declined to comment further on the allegations. In response to the suit, White filed an answer, saying that he had acted in good faith both personally and as DA, and that Phillips had, quote, "failed to initiate action under the requisite grievance or appeal procedures," end quote. The suit was filed under the Texas Whistleblowers Act, which says that if an employee is terminated within 90 days of reporting a violation of the law, there's a legal presumption that that is what led to the termination. The Whistleblower Act also requires the suit to be filed within 90 days after the violation occurred. Phillips was fired on May 28th, and he filed his suit exactly 90 days later on August 26th. The suit was filed in district court in Travis County, home of the state capitol, since the Texas Whistleblowers Act allows plaintiffs to file there or in a district court of the county in which the cause of action arises. Three of the counties named as defendants in the suit have filed to request the venue be moved to district court in the local counties. Brewster, Presidio, and Jeff Davis County's attorney, Eric Britton, argues that while the act allows the claim to be filed in Travis County, another state code on civil cases makes it mandatory for a suit against a county to be filed in that same county. However, the local district judge may be a material witness in the case, and the counties where the cause of action arose are themselves defendants, which could cause conflict. On Wednesday, as the Big Bend Sentinel was going to press, A number of affidavits from both private citizens and elected officials were filed in support of the claim that there would be no fair and impartial trial if the venue was moved back into district court in Presidio, Brewster, Jeff Davis, or Pecos counties. The Big Bend Sentinel will continue to follow the story. Staff photo by Maisie Crow. 83rd District Attorney Ori White presents Presidio County Attorney Rod Ponton with a $17,500 check in April of this year. Historic restoration project at Big Bend National Park spotlights Marfan's Adobe expertise by Sam Karras. Sam at BigBendSentinel.com. Big Bend National Park. It was barely 10 a.m. and everyone was sweating through their shirts. Temperatures were creeping into the low 90s, but the team was in good spirits, lobbing jokes and laughing to the percussion of metal on plaster. David Keller, an archaeologist at Sul Ross University, was up on the roof, trying to wrangle mud bricks and wet mortar into a straight line, not without a few profanities. Silla Marfa's Joey Benton looked up from his spot in the shade of the scaffolding, a big wet glob of earth plaster balanced on his trowel. A little crooked, huh? I'm making it look authentic, Keller said. For most visitors to Big Bend National Park, the Alvino House, downhill from the seasonal ranger station in the Castellon Historic District, is not a destination. Despite its location just a few yards away from one of the busiest roads in the park, only a simple wooden sign marks the rocky path down to the site. Hundreds of people drive by it every day on their way to nearby Santa Elena Canyon without a second thought. To Keller, Benton, and the crew, it's a landmark. The Alvino House is the oldest standing adobe structure in the park, dating back to 1903. While it was spared from a wildfire that devastated the area in 2019, little had been done to protect and stabilize the structure in over 100 years. The house's story begins with Cipriano Hernandez, who left his home in Camargo in the late 19th century for the silver mines at Shafter. After striking out there, he decided to try his luck farming and selling produce in the floodplain below what's now called Castellon. Hernandez started construction on the house in 1901, which doubled in size as it changed hands over the years. Around 1918, Alvino Ibarra, a mason and mechanic after whom the house is named, moved in. While the area has always been remote, it hasn't always been unpopulated. At the turn of the century, there were a handful of villages between Castellon and Santa Elena. The homes of the area were always well kept, and flowers could be found blooming in the yards in all seasons of the year. Ibarra remembered in a 1967 interview with the Park's Office of Archaeology and Historic Preservation. Castellon is now home to a seasonal ranger station and a general store that offers snacks, beer, and frozen dinners to passers-by. But there's much more to its history than a pit stop on the way to Santa Elena Canyon. Military interest in the site was sparked in 1860 when Lieutenant William Eccles departed from a camp on the Devil's River with his men on camelback. The soldiers rode camels all the way to Presidio and followed the river to the present-day site of Castellon. The mission was twofold: to decide if the U.S. military should adopt camels as a form of transport on the southwestern frontier, and to find a suitable camp halfway between the two branches of the Comanche Trail. Just before the Civil War, fighting the Comanche was the military's top priority, and seasonal bands of hunters were known to cross at Lajitas and at Woodson's, about 20 miles downstream from the mouth of Santa Elena Canyon. The camels' feet were worse for the wear on the rocky, spiny terrain of the Big Bend, but that spot on a hill over the floodplain, with spectacular canyon views, was exactly what the military was looking for. The Civil War diverted attention away from the Southwest, but when the military returned to Castellón during the Mexican Revolution, anticipating gunfire and border trouble, the nearby post at Glen Springs had been ransacked by Villistas in 1916. They returned to a peaceful pastoral scene. Beans, squash, watermelon, wheat, and other crops were being sold out of the Alvino house. The produce served the local community all the way to Terlingua, where workers at the bustling Mercury mines were in need of fresh food. Barracks were constructed a few hundred yards away, just in time for troops to be withdrawn in 1919. The residents of these remote frontier outposts were accustomed to recycling. An enterprising businessman named Wayne Cartledge bought the abandoned military buildings up the hill from Alvino Ibarra and his family and opened La Harmonia, a general mercantile whose name reflected the owner's wishes for the binational, bilingual community he served. Ibarra worked as a mason and as a mechanic for Cartledge's cotton gin for much of the time he lived in the house. In 1957, the house was sold to the National Park Service and fell into disrepair. The park is a natural history park, not a cultural history park, Keller said. It's not any one person's fault, but there's been a real neglect of historic structures over the years. He hopes the completed structure will be an opportunity for the park to grow its historic preservation and cultural interpretation programs. I hope this project inspires them to step up their game, he said. I don't want to do all this work and have no one come down here. I hope it'll be a destination cultural site when we're done. Despite their reputation for being simple and straightforward, adobe buildings require routine maintenance. The main thing about adobes is they're like sponges, and they breathe like sponges, Benton explained. Ideally, you'd have a yearly maintenance program that takes care of the plaster. Benton, who started out in metalwork and carpentry, has grown his business to include adobe restoration and has been trusted with a number of historic structures in Marfa, including a series of private homes on Officers Row, and worked with the Chinati Foundation on the Chamberlain Building downtown. Every project is its own vernacular. It's tied to the place that you are. That's not true of any other kind of construction, but it's really true with adobe, he said. Materials are free, basically. The only real cost in adobe construction is labor. And it's quiet. It's really pleasant work. You're basically playing with mud. Luis Madrid, who worked at the post office in Marfa for over 30 years, came out of retirement to work with Benton on adobe restoration projects. These buildings have been here for 100 years, and maybe we can keep them going for another 30. Keller's interest in adobe was sparked by his home in Alpine. He spent much of COVID lockdown testing different clays around the region with the hopes of being able to advise Big Bend locals from across the region on adobe projects. It'll just melt back into the earth, and that's how it should be. Not a big pile of toxic crap, which is most of our houses. While Keller spends as much time as he can making bricks and plaster, a lot of his work is fundraising behind the scenes. Originally billed as a 5-year project funded by the park and Sol Ross, high turnover in Park Service Administration has made applying for funding a turbulent process. 3 years in, the project is now funded by the Big Bend Conservancy, a Friends organization that supports the park. Whenever he applies for funding, he makes it clear that he and Benton's team are a package deal. He's a mud freak, and I'm a mud freak, and we work well together. Staff photos by Sam Karras. David Keller touches up the adobe brickwork on the roof of the Alvino House. Individual adobe bricks dry in the sun outside the Alvino House. Keller and Benton's team have been making 250 bricks a week and estimate the project will require 1,000 bricks to complete the house. In pre-pandemic format, Chinati Weekend and its crowd returned to Marfa. Photo by Alex Marks. El Paso bagpiper Marla Manning marches through the arena at Chinati Foundation during the Saturday night community dinner. I didn't even realize how loud it was in the arena, but when I stopped, you could hear the reverberation in the room. That was pretty neat, Manning said of the experience. By Abby Perot. Abby, ABBIE, at BigBendSentinel.com. Marfa, the Chinati Foundation celebrated its biggest event of the year this weekend, marking the 34th edition of Chinati Weekend in Marfa. Turnout and spirits were high as visitors and locals alike tread the familiar ground of Fort D.A. Russell, seeing new special exhibitions and revamped permanent installations, and hearing a range of musical stylings throughout the weekend, all in the name and legacy of Donald Judd. After the previous year's online-only event, the foundation wasn't sure what to expect for 2021. As the Marfa area received high rates of vaccinations and largely kept its case count down, the foundation opted to return to its old form this October, inviting people back on property and reviving the community-centric free dinner on Saturday. Exhibitions, open studios, shops, and restaurants were bustling during Made in Marfa on Friday, and multiple local watering holes reopened their doors to welcome the influx of both guests in town and the locals who came out to enjoy the many special events. As the gates of Chinati swung open, the foundation saw the return of longtime art enthusiasts who have made the same pilgrimage for Chinati Weekend for decades, a fleet of locals emerging after the previous year's shutdowns, as well as an extra swell of a new art set of collectors and tech fans brought into Marfa by the cryptocurrency-tied Art Blocks Gallery that opened over the weekend. After a year apart, Chinati Foundation Director Ginny Moore said attendees seemed grateful to gather together again. It both felt normal and it felt really joyful, and all of us needed that after such a difficult time. In planning for the event, which is the foundation's biggest fundraiser of the year, Moore had expected a good crowd of people to attend, despite the break in in-person programming last year. On Saturday morning, attendees turned out in droves to see a special performance by David Dove and a cadre of musicians as they performed within the six buildings that make up Dan Flavin's untitled Marfa Project 1996. Viewers escaped the hot morning sun by ducking into each of the Flavin buildings, the first hosting complete silence, while the other five had a musician tucked into one side of the U-shaped former barracks, the sound reverberating and passing through the fluorescent artwork. To see people engaging with the Flavins for that duration of time was really special, Moore said. It was really great seeing people going back through time and again. you were having a different experience through it musically, but as you were being engaged acoustically, it made you re-engage the work over and over again. Moore said that instead of bringing in the usual dozens of volunteers from out of town, the foundation opted this year to hire local teachers who made excellent docents due to their skills at managing groups. Sandra Hinojos, the foundation's office manager, who has been with the organization for 28 years, said that over the years, one of the biggest changes at Chinati Weekend has been the growth of the crowds. I feel like more people are involved and want to be a part of it. It's art enthusiasts. Locals seem to be participating a little bit more, and they're enjoying and looking forward to coming out to the community dinner, Hinojos said. The change is good, she believes. It got people out, especially after COVID, she said. It was good to actually interact with people and be a part of something. And she enjoyed seeing the growing crowd at the arena for Saturday night's dinner, noting the great atmosphere the music brought this year. As the sun retreated Saturday evening, hundreds of folks gathered at the arena for a meal fit for a cowboy and plenty of entertainment and drinks to accompany it. The iconic wood and glass pivoting doors were open as music flowed out into additional outdoor seating, where the community was able to finally gather after the previous year's all-virtual affair. Presidio's own mariachi, Santa Cruz, serenaded the crowd throughout the meal. As the crowd settled in and the sun dipped low at the horizon, El Paso-based bagpiper Marla Manning began a procession from off in the distance. The musician has played bagpipes for 38 years and played her first show in Marfa back in the mid-1980s. On Saturday, she pulled out a pie-bridged to perform, one of Judd's favorite types of bagpipe music. Playing Strawn Robertson's Salute, she marched through the grounds around the arena and then indoors. While she'd performed for Chinati Weekend last year virtually, Manning said, "For me, it's better playing in front of a crowd, just because your adrenaline kicks in and you have more energy, so it's more fun. You connect with people." The count at the Saturday night dinner was 780, Moore said. It was definitely one of our most well-attended Chinati weekends. On Sunday morning, as the scheduled events wound down, Moore surveyed the vast expanse of the Chinati Foundation property Judd had purchased decades back on the south side of Marfa. She remarked, "Sunday morning at sunrise, I saw more people down at the concrete works than I've ever seen in my time."
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the Fort Stockton Pioneer for Thursday, October 14th, 2021. Big Bend Open Road Race 2.0 set by Nathan Hewer. Engines will roar and adrenaline will be pumping through some of the best racers in West Texas come Saturday morning in Fort Stockton. The Big Bend Open Road Race 2.0 will take place on October 16th, and the day will conclude with an award ceremony at the Pecos County Civic Center starting at 7:30 p.m. Week-long race activities will nearly be identical to the festivities held for the Big Bend Open Road Race in April. The two significant changes to the activities leading up to the race is the location of where the parade will begin and where the car show will be held. Both previously were at Rooney Park and now will be held or begin at the CVB Convention Center, formerly Stockton's Entertainment. The car show will begin at 4 p.m. on Friday, October 15th, and be followed by a parade starting at 5:30. The parade will begin at the plaza and head east down Dickinson Boulevard. The parade will then turn onto Main Street before concluding at Rooney Park. Fort Stockton CVB Director Crystal Lopez stated last week, There are over 100 drivers signed up to race in divisions ranging from 85 to 200 miles per hour. The number isn't far off the amount racers that competed in the first road race of the year, which was reported to be over 130. Fort Stockton Mayor Chris Alexander said that the turnout for this weekend's race will likely dictate whether a second race is held in a calendar year for the foreseeable future. If it's a good turnout for us, we'll get the weekend locked in advance so people can plan for two of them, if they want to do two or one. The idea to have a second race in the same year derived largely from hotel motel owners, as well as local businesses requesting the CVB host another because of the significant economic benefit. In the CVB meeting, talking to the hotel motel people, he said that's the one event, if we're going to have two, that's the one they want to be, they want, because they see the biggest benefit out of it. Since the tax pays for a lot, we try to help them out the best we can. The economic benefit is probably not going to be as big as the one in April due to the number of drivers, but it still will have a huge impact on our economy. PCMH awarded $180,000 grant by Megan Waring. New patient furniture will soon be attained by Pecos County Memorial Hospital. The FMH Foundation awarded a $180,000 grant to PCMH on October 12th at the Pecos County Commissioners' Court meeting. The commissioners approved the grant for the replacement of hospital and clinic patient care equipment. This is for patient furniture, PCMH CEO Betsy Briscoe said. So the sleeper chairs and couches, as well as vital sign monitors and patient exam beds. Established in 2011, the FMH Foundation awards grants to organizations located in the Permian Basin area of Texas. The foundation has provided over 450 grants to over 110 agencies to date. Commissioners also approved Briscoe to be authorized to apply and sign for any grant assistance under the Rules and Regulations of Rural Housing Services, which is a department of the United States Department of Agriculture. This gives Betsy the opportunity to be the signatory. That way, whenever the hospital is dealing with grants, she can sign off on it, Pecos County Judge Joe Schuster said. Appointment made to the Animal Control Advisory Board by Megan Waring. Heather Pass, who currently serves as the Convention and Visitors Bureau, will also now serve on the Animal Control Advisory Board. The appointment was approved by Fort Stockton City Council during the regular meeting held Tuesday, October 12th. According to the City Council, there should not be any scheduling conflicts for Pass serving on multiple boards because they meet at different times. Following a resignation, the Fort Stockton Police Department does have an animal control officer vacancy. There are currently 3 dogs and 1 cat in the shelter with a capacity of 20. We are doing well, but we are holding our own right now, said Chief of Police Robert Lujan. There are also vacancies in patrol and dispatch, according to Lujan. City Council approves parking solutions at Roofing Business by Megan Waring. To make it more convenient for the business owner, Tom's Roofing will have 2 designated parallel parking spaces in front of the building. The Fort Stockton City Council approved these parking adjustments for the downtown Main Street area, located within 1 block radius between 4th and 5th Street, during its regular meeting on October 12th. While there is only striped parking on that side of the street, business owner Tom Lozano parks parallel due to having a trailer hitched up to the back of his truck. I talk with Tom, said Council Member Darren Hodges. Sometimes he's got something behind his truck and he would prefer to park parallel there. This would only affect Tom's Roofing and no other business downtown. Vaughn Brothers Artwork Dedicated by Natalie Camogan. It's official. Dallas has finally unveiled a monument to 2 of its best-known hometown musical talents. Hundreds of blues and rock and roll fans gathered Sunday afternoon at Killis Park in Oak Cliff for the formal unveiling of a sculpture dedicated to Stevie Ray and Jimmy Vaughn, blocks from where the brothers grew up on Glenfield Avenue. Jimmy and Stephen Ray's stories, now known around the world, fittingly started right here in Dallas, which is the birthplace of the Texas Blues, said Dallas Mayor Eric Johnson, who declared the day Vaughn Brothers Day. The unveiling, delayed by the COVID-19 pandemic, was the official debut of the metal mural, which was installed in March 2020. The unveiling was timed for what would have been Stevie Ray Vaughan's 67th birthday. The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductee died in a helicopter crash in August 1990 in Wisconsin, along with several members of his entourage following a concert. The influential blues guitarist was the frontman of Double Trouble. Jimmy Vaughan, 70, may be best known for his work with the Fabulous Thunderbirds, but he has released many albums under his own name since leaving that band. Shortly before Stevie Ray Vaughan's death, the brothers recorded the album Family Style, which Johnson described as the sound of two boys who were raised in Oak Cliff. The sculpture, created by Spanish artist Casto Solano, stands about 10 feet tall near the entrance of the park on Hampton Road and features lyrics from the brothers' song TikTok, with its themes of universal love, peace, and understanding. Also carved into the sculpture are images of the brothers as young men. The COVID-delayed unveiling marked the end of years of setbacks. The public art at Killis Park, named We Are Music and Music Is Us, pays tribute to the musical contributions of Dallas natives Jimmy and Stevie Ray Vaughan. In 2018, filmmaker and Pecos County resident Kirby Warnock formed a group to support the effort to honor the Vaughan brothers and raised money for the artwork, hoping it would be unveiled that year. After the city's Office of Arts and Culture got approval from the Park Board, the unveiling was initially planned for December 2019, but Solano made the sculpture's four steel panels taller than expected, which meant the foundation had to be redesigned so the work could withstand winds. Before it was postponed, the unveiling had been set for March of 2020 to coincide with Jimmy Vaughan's birthday. Following remarks from Warnock, Austin-born musician Gary Clark Jr., City Council member Carolyn King Arnold, and other city officials, Vaughan played Six Strings Down, a song he wrote about his brother Stevie, for the crowd. "It's amazing to think about all this," Jimmy Vaughan said. "You're all here, too. Thank you. Stevie's here, too."
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Monahans News for Thursday, October 7th. Two charged with aggravated sexual assault of a child. The story was read by Christy Sullivan. Two Monahans men were arrested and booked into the Ward County Jail last week on a felony charge of aggravated sexual assault of a child. Jonathan Calder, age 33, of 514 West 11th Street, and Jimmy Ray Gonzalez, age 40, of 605 South Kenneth, were both picked up for the felony warrants on Monday, September 29th. According to Lieutenant Stormy Laws, quote, "The police department was called to the 500 block of East 16th Street on June 21st in reference to a possible sexual assault of a female victim who was under 14 years of age," end quote. During the course of the investigation, it was learned that the alleged offense occurred on June 19th, and Calder was named as a suspect to the felony offense. Quote, "The case was turned over to Lieutenant Jeremy Kynes, who is the felony case investigator for the police department," he added. Calder was interviewed by Kynes, and based on information received, an arrest warrant was obtained on September 22nd. In the second case, an outcry was made at the police department on July 2nd of a sexual assault of a child which occurred approximately 10 years ago in the 600 block of South Kenneth Street. Quote, "The victim, who was under the age of 14 at the time of the alleged offense, came to the police department to report the alleged abuse from 10 years ago," Laws said. Through the course of the investigation, Gonzalez was named a suspect to the felony crime. Investigator Lieutenant Kynes conducted two interviews with the suspect on September 7th and 21st, and based on information received during those interviews, an arrest warrant was issued for Gonzalez. There is no statute of limitations for sexual assault of a child in Texas, Laws said. In both cases, the accused were known to the family of the victim. Calder and Gonzalez were subsequently arrested on September 29th and are charged with aggravated sexual assault of a child, a first-degree felony due to the age of the victim at the time of the offense. The offense can be punishable by imprisonment in the Texas Department of Criminal Justice for any term of 5 to 99 years or life and a fine not to exceed $10,000. Calder and Gonzalez were released from custody after posting their $25,000 bonds. COVID cases dropping sharply. The story was written by Paul Cyphers. Last Wednesday, the number of active cases of COVID-19 had started to drop dramatically in Ward County and the state. Last Wednesday morning, the number of cases had dropped to 165. The number of cases seemed to peak at 219 on September 18th. On Wednesday morning, the number of active cases had dropped even further to 127 active cases. Also, there were 1,191 confirmed cases, 611 probable, 1,649 recoveries, and 26 deaths as of Wednesday morning. Statewide, there were 124,000 active cases, 3.4 million confirmed, 677,000 probable, 65,062 deaths, and 3.8 million recovered. County Judge Greg Holley said on Monday, quote, "Our numbers continue to decline, which is great news. It certainly appears that we are headed down the backside of the surge we've experienced during the last 10 weeks or so. Praying that this trend continues and that we're back down in very low numbers again soon." Likewise, the regional hospital situation continues to improve. For those of us in rural counties, having regional transfer options is important. We transfer patients further away for certain types of specialized care, but in general, we prefer to keep folks closer to home when possible. End quote. Big Green Band places third in Denver City Marching Festival. The Monahans High School Big Green Marching Band came away with a third-place finish Saturday evening during the Tumbleweed Marching Festival held at Mustang Stadium in Denver City. Monahans finished third behind first-place Odessa High School and runner-up Whiteface High School. Around 20 bands from around the area competed in the preliminary round, and only 7 bands made it to the final round. Quote, "I am very proud of our performances on Saturday. The band has worked very hard to be prepared. We will continue to work and make improvements over the next 2 weeks," MHS Head Band Director Joe Barrow said. The band began that work to make improvements on Monday night at a clinic with a special guest clinician, the composer of this year's music, and former Texas Band Director Barry Hurt. The band's show is titled Black Gold. Quote, "We are excited about this year's music. It depicts the many aspects of the Permian oil industry and West Texas," he added. The Big Green Band took first place in the Class 4A prelims and were sitting second going into finals. They also received Outstanding Color Guard and Best Drum Majors, according to Barrow. The band will compete at UIL Marching Contest on October 16th at Ratliff Stadium in Odessa. Quote, "It is very important in order to be able to move forward to the UIL Area A competition later in October and the Texas State Marching Competition in early November," he said. Normally, the band only advances to state every other years, but due to COVID last year, the state is allowing all classifications to advance this year. Barrow said, quote, Everyone is invited to come to Ratliff Stadium on the 16th or our next home game on October 22nd to enjoy the show." End quote.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of Far West Texas. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.